You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. Anyone can become an agent of innovation. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Welcome to Trillions. I'm Joel Weber.
And I'm Eric Balchunas.
Eric, you do some conferences. You recently went to the Conference on Emerging Trends in Asset Management, and you seem to think you walked out of there as a really big deal.
No, I walked out of there a lot smarter.
Okay.
A lot of times when I do a conference and I'm on a panel, I don't go for the whole thing.
Yeah.
But this one seems special. I got an email from the current director of investment management. It's their first conference. They had seen me do a book presentation about a year ago, and they were like, this guy would be good to give some sort of, you know, alternative take on the ETF market. There were several people there, a lot of lawyers, and a lot of people from the SEC.
Several people, like there are like five people there, and one of them happened to be Gary Gensler, the head of the SEC?
Yeah, he spoke. So that's why I went, because I wanted to see him speak and some of the other people. So I went and just stayed the whole time, and I was at the end, but I soaked up a lot. And I wanted to sort of somehow get this onto the podcast. And I found the way to do that because I met Dahlia Blas, who used to be the head of investment management at the SEC. And I got to meet her at dinner a little bit more, and we expanded, and I saw her on the panel. And some of the things she was talking about are stuff we write about all the time. So I thought we could dive a little bit into what the SEC does, some of the current topics that were brought up at this event. Because this is the first one, and you know, SEC is not usually this open, but they were pretty open. They're trying to, I guess, be a little more available to people and say exactly what they're doing. And I thought it was a good time to check in on all this. And she has a very interesting background, and I had seen, you know, and heard of her obviously over the years, but finally got to meet her. And believe it or not, she accepted my invitation to join the podcast.
So we're going to speak with Dahlia Blas, who is the former SEC Division of Investment Management head. After that, she went to BlackRock, where she was head of external affairs, and now she's a partner at Sullivan & Cromwell. This time on Trillions, Dahlia Blas. Dahlia, welcome to Trillions.
Thank you for having me.
So how was Eric received within this conference that he seems to think everybody like really cared about what came out of his mouth? How was it really?
Honestly? truthfully, so you know, Eric had a really good presentation. Aside from the fact, like a lot of bar charts, whatnot. Sorry, Eric, I wasn't paying attention to those. But he explained some really complicated principles around ETFs and ETF investing in a way that really resonated. Very, very plain English, and was talking about the trends in the space that you know were really interesting. I think the most interesting trend you talked about, Eric, is how much the AUM, the assets under management for ETFs, frankly, have like doubled at least since the ETF rule. So that made me really happy to hear that since, you know, I was the director when we did the ETF rule. So great, great stats. And it was just really understandable, which was great.
And one quick thing on that, I found when Gary Gensler spoke, he was going through several topics. He'd be like private equity. We're looking at this. We need to be careful about this. Then he'd be like, money market funds. We're looking at this. We've got to be careful of this. It seems like ETFs got a pretty much a pass. He basically said, you know, ETFs, look, they're great. They brought diversity and convenience to investors. And he kind of just went on. So I'll give you some credit for that. I guess the ETF rule maybe cleaned up all the things they were looking at. But it didn't seem like that was on his radar compared to the other things.
I think it was a product lineup that was sort of like, this is working really well. It worked really well in March 2020. Thank you so much. Let's move on to other areas. And it was heartening to hear that, quite frankly, because I think you would recall for years before 2020, it was always the where's the moment that ETFs will break? Where's the moment ETFs will break? That was always the narrative. So it was really heartening to see that this is a product that actually was a pressure valve in March 2020.
Yeah, and I think this was the one, March 2020 is when I think all the doubters, the some worry articles kind of were like, okay, they're good. Because you're right, there was, especially fixed income ETFs, there was all this worry about it. And then when the Fed stepped in to buy them, I think that really sealed the deal. It's like, well, the Fed's going to use them. They must be okay.
Yeah, there was a sense of the ETFs were helping in March 2020. As I said, there was like a pressure valve release sort of, you know, mechanic, if you will, and ETFs played that role really well. And the government acknowledged that. So it was, I agree with you. In his speech, it was really interesting how he dealt with ETFs compared to the other pieces that he talked about.
So you got to the SEC September of 2017, the before times. How much did you know about ETFs when you got there?
So that was my third tour of duty, because we speak military terms in the government. So believe it or not, I was the staff attorney that did the original ETF proposal in, was it 07, 08? And it took a second try to get it to final. So I've lived ETFs at the commission since a very long time ago.
Okay. All right. She like... Tour of duty. I mean, when you do that, is that for real? Is it like how we talk about it?
It is. It's right. It's your tour of duty in the government, even when you're in civilian service. So that was my third tour in 2017.
Yeah, if you got into ETFs, I feel like if you got into ETFs before 2010, especially 2008,
you're like an OG.
Kind of. Yeah. You know, you're not OOG like you know, Bob Toll and those guys and Nate Most, but second level. Because the industry was only like $400 billion back then. Again, today, $7 trillion.
So when you first started to work on ETF stuff at the SEC, what were the concerns that you were wrestling with then?
So, you know, ETFs, as Eric mentioned, it was a growing space, but nothing compared to where it was in 2018 when we re-proposed. A lot of it was still index. Some of the actives were starting. The conversations around the non-transparent, the veiled ETFs, but there were none on the market at all. The questions there were more, and if you look at the old proposal, we tried to enshrine the index ETF versus the active ETF. It was just simplistic, if you will, compared to where we ended up after a lot more experience with the product in the marketplace.
Let's go into the 1940 Act a little bit. This is the main act that governs a lot of the funds world. The 1940 Act, ETFs always needed an exception to the 1940 Act. And I guess, can you just talk a little bit about how ETFs are structured? I think some people don't realize they are mutual funds to a degree. They just have this extra exemption.
They're open-ended funds, right? So the Act, if you will, has two pieces, the closed ends, the open ends, and the open ends, the feature there is it's redeemable. Like I give you back my share, you give me back my money, right? That redeemable and within a very short time period. The statute is 7 days. In reality, it's like a day. The ETF exemptions, which again, when you grow in the exemptive application process, and I think that was one of the issues when we did the proposal in 08 and definitely when we did the rulemaking in 2018 that ended up being the final, exemptions over time change because the market evolves. So the ETF providers that had the original orders had vastly different orders than the ETF providers that had orders leading up to the final rule. So when you step back and you look at that, it's not an equal marketplace. You know, even though like, you know, I'm going to go out and buy an ETF, I'm buying an ETF that in name looks like any other ETF, but in principle could have, you know, vastly different things. So, you know, stepping back and just saying like, what really is different about an ETF compared to a mutual fund and what do I need to change? And this is where when we looked at it, we're like, ETF is a redeemable security. We don't need to give an exemption from that. So when you look at the final ETF rule, the exemptions actually are a lot fewer, a lot cleaner than when you look at any exemptive application that predated that rule. And that's the experience you have and that you can do when you're looking at a rulemaking, which you can't really do with an exemptive order. It's still like kind of bound by a lot of history behind it, if you will.
A little bit of history. We learned that SEC kind of helped create the ETF originally after the Black Monday report. Do people in the SEC appreciate that? And is there any internal pride about creating this whole sort of new way of investing?
So if you're talking about the spiders,
mm-hmm.
which took quite a few.
It did. 4.5 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, the SEC issued this huge telephone book size report that was a postmortem on the 87 crash. And in there talked a little bit about, well, if there had been a market basking trading instrument that actually had physically backed securities instead of using the futures market in Chicago, this might have not happened.
And Amex looked at that and were like, we can do that.
Yeah, so that's, it's not, you know, the SEC has actually played a role in innovation. If you look at interval funds, by way of example, that was created by the commission. It was also an SEC creation, right? So, and that's a really important point, because that's a point sometimes we don't focus on. We focus on the SEC being the administrator of like the 40 Act and the other securities laws. We focus on the SEC being the examiner for compliance. We focus on the SEC being the enforcer.
That's the fun part.
What we don't focus on, and perhaps sometimes the SEC, and I'm guilty of that, having been inside the building for 14 years. We don't sometimes focus on the SEC's role in innovation, which is really, really important for a marketplace as well.
So the ETF rule, when it came about, what was different about it on your third tour of duty than your previous ones? And why did you change your mind to get it to where it ended up?
So, the ETF rule, if you look at it compared to the one that was proposed in 08, significantly different. Like, just by way of one example, you don't have the index ETF versus the active ETF. You have the ETF. You don't have an idea that the ETF is getting an exemption from being a redeemable security. It's acknowledged that it is a redeemable security. It's an open-end fund. So these were all things that came with lessons learned. The commission, the staff had vastly more experience by 2018 compared to 10 years earlier, and the product had grown by, leaps and bounds. So the thinking had matured, the product had matured, and it continues to mature. So it's maybe perhaps not so good that it took 10 years, but at the same time, I think the rule ended up where it is because of the more information and the more experience the staff and the commissions had with the product.
So let's switch to a topic that came up at the event. This is your panel, and it came up a couple times at the event, which was, okay, you've got two companies, BlackRock, Vanguard. You could throw State Street in there. We'll call them the big three. They're getting bigger. They sort of more the center focus. They're becoming like a political football because they own so much of these stocks. I think Vanguard owns about 8 or 9%. BlackRock owns about 7% of almost every stock in America. And so the question is, like, how do we deal with this? Because they're not getting any smaller. They take in most of the money, so they're going to keep getting bigger. And this was a topic that was talked about. And then what was brought up was, well, the market is sort of working this out because they're going to decentralize voting and let their shareholders have a say. I guess from your vantage point as having worked at BlackRock and the SEC, how do you see this playing out over the next 10 years?
That's a great question, and you're right. This was a topic in the IM Emerging Trends Conference that I think almost every single panel touched on, which even panels that didn't have that in their title, it seemed to be a topic everybody was interested in talking about. The bottom line is you're hearing increasingly both policymakers and investors asking for changes in fund voting practices. This is not about like a big two or a big three or a big four or a big five or a big six. It's about index funds and how they're managing their voting. Some policymakers have raised questions about the increasing share of index fund voting and how those shares are being cast. And you have investors today, institutional investors, who want, just as they choose how their investments are being deployed into the market, they also want to say in how their shares are being voted in the market. So when you have that, and not getting into merits or demerits of any around that, you look at solutions, because solutions are already starting to come about. You have solutions I think I would characterize in three buckets. You have sort of restrictive voting solutions, which would put sort of parameters around what index fund managers would or would not do. You have more transparency solutions, which are very limiting. And then you have market-based solutions, which I think the market-based solutions are the ones that have greater promise. And if we can sort of allow them to evolve and the regulators step in a place of helping the conversations and removing any regulatory barriers, I think you can get a movement in fund voting that would actually really inure to the benefit of all investors.
And let's talk about the rules currently in place. A fund cannot own more than 10% of a company. I think that's the rule in the 40 Act, but it doesn't say anything about a fund complex, because the 40 Act came out when typically a fund was all the complex had. Now, in the past, 80 years, the fund multiplied, and now they have 300-400 funds. So there's no rule, and so therefore BlackRock and Vanguard could really get bigger, own more than 10%. But that's okay, because it's really 30 to 50 million investors, individual investors' money, if they decentralize, versus people thinking that and this comes up all the time on Twitter, like, it looks like BlackRock and Vanguard have like so much power and it's their money, but it's really a bunch of, it's millions of individual investors.
So a couple of things. Number one, the restrictions on ownership, there is like a myriad of things that play here, right? Of where the restrictions come from federal law, from state law. There is a lot going on. But also sort of, and I, you know, I've heard you say, and at the conference, I heard it repeatedly said, you know, people saying a BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street. I think it's really important to remember that these are independent entities that invest independently and that, you know, invest, you know, on the basis of what their clients are choosing for them to invest. So we can't talk about them collectively. That's something that's really important to note. The other piece to note is that this is a very large and very diverse industry. You're talking about an industry that's well over $100 trillion globally, well over, like maybe 110, 120. So when you look at how much they hold compared to that vast global, it just gives you a sense of like how big this industry is. It's very diversified, a lot of players, a lot of choice in this industry. You know, that said, as I said, like there are policymakers and investors who want different solutions when it comes to voting, but it's important to look at what is happening and also the benefits that these providers have brought to the table when it comes to voting, when it comes to the economies of scale they have created for funds, as we look at any solutions in this space.
And one thing that was brought up by a lawyer from Virginia, she said something I thought was interesting, which is there's too much demand for the regulatory supply when it comes to some of these issues like climate. Like the government really hasn't done a lot. And so but there's all this demand built up to do something. And it's been put on the asset managers who you could argue are getting too much pressure for what their role is in society because of that lack of progress by the government itself. I thought that was a pretty decent point. That was somebody who was basically trying to say, chill on the asset managers, okay? They're not going to solve everything here. But their pressure is huge. And I do think if there was something done with the laws, this wouldn't be as big of a topic. So I do think that's part of at play here.
Well, you've been on both sides of that, right? You've been in the government side and you've been in the private sector, at publicly traded company. Like, how do you thread that needle? Or how do you think we should be threading that needle?
So, you know, when you look at asset managers, you know, asset managers are looking at their clients. Their clients are the ones that provide the mandates. For the institutional clients, the mandates can be more complicated, obviously. But for retail invests on the basis of funds, and funds have very specific mandates, and the client is choosing that. So, you know, for asset managers, the first point, the foundation is client choice. Everything else comes from that choice the client makes. And you have a lot of clients who are very interested in the ESG space and funds that target certain you know, climate solutions or certain solutions to very pressing social policies. That is what the client wants, right? And so, you know, asset managers are just that. They're not the asset owners. They are the asset managers. When it comes to the government, you know, where you would look for what you'd look for as a regulated entity and in this really complex space, frankly, is clarity. What is the roadmap? What can you do? What can you not do? And have that clarity so that you can fulfill your mission, especially here for advisors, as a fiduciary to the clients who are entrusting you with their assets.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 Index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Let's talk about ESG-related, except the funds themselves. So one of Gensler's current priorities, or at least one of his things he's looking at, is ESG ETFs. And I've traveled around. I've worked with our ESG team. There's a huge debate about what you're actually getting with an ESG ETF. Some, like the biggest one, ESGU, which is the biggest one, the holdings look a lot like the S&P. There's a couple things taken out, but it's very close, just a little tilt away from the index. Then there's ones that go more hardcore. We actually have a scoring system we try to help investors. But how much is naming an issue with the SEC when a product comes in? How much do you need to worry about what it holds and what it does versus just sort of letting a lot of freedom in what you name it and what you hold as long as you spell it out in the prospectus?
So, like, without getting into any specific funds or fund names, I'm not a portfolio manager, and you don't want me to be a portfolio manager. When you look at ESG, the term itself, in my opinion, is a problem. It's very imprecise. It brings together three very broad terms under this one. One moniker, if you will. And, you know, let me illustrate with the most simplistic of examples, and I will say very simplistic examples. You could have one fund that targets investments in companies that have a net zero goal. That's an ESG fund. You can have another fund that avoids sin stocks. I will not invest in alcohol, guns, whatnot. That's an ESG fund. You can have another fund that targets companies that have particular board characteristics. That's also an ESG fund. So if you are an investor and you're interested in funds and interested in putting your money in funds that will help, you know, with climate solutions, and you just do ESG funds, then what do you do with that? And how do you get to that bottom of, like, I want not just broad umbrella ESG, I want funds that target climate solutions. So there is a problem with the term. And when you look at the SEC rule, and by the way, I think I would note the SEC, in trying to bring clarity to the space, that is a good thing. That's important for investors because here you're talking about retail products. So it's really important to bring clarity. But if you're doubling down on this term that is just so broad and includes so much, are you really going to bring clarity to space?
It's a difficult question because some, like, advisors may want watered down ESG. They may want just a slight tilt because they don't like tracking error. But an ESG advocate would argue that's not really ESG investing. And so same thing happens in smart beta. There's value ETFs that are just barely value. And a quant would be like, that's not really value investing. You got to go hardcore. So I don't know. It's tough to police this in general. But I think the names, when I wrote my first book, I had the golden rule of ETF investing is never totally trust the name. You know, definitely look at the holdings, no matter what it's called or no matter how good of a job it does, because sometimes the names don't quite match up.
Well, extension of what Eric's asked you, how much does the SEC look at the ticker itself and care about what's in the ticker or what's implied by the ticker, maybe?
So I want to touch on names and ticker. So first, names. Names are important, but I would really hope that we're not buying funds based on just the name.
We would hope.
Yeah.
Well, there was this whole meme stock moment. That was kind of yeah. part of what drove that moment.
Yeah. But, you know, that just really hope that's not where, like, at least, like, the look at the fact sheet, right? There is, and by the way, if you're going through a financial professional, like an advisor or a broker, then they're looking beyond the name. And self-directed investors are actually ones that believe they have, like, they want to be self-directed. They're choosing to be self-directed. They have facility with the market. So I don't know if they're just looking at the name. So I wouldn't want us to overplay. Name is important, truth in advertising. but it shouldn't be such a huge focus that we lose sort of track of, like, it cannot be the only component. On the ticker, I mean, I will tell you this. I mean, you could you could spend time arguing with a fund on a name, and then they get an interesting ticker.
Hold on. I'm going to jump in. I know what you're thinking of. The blockchain ETF. They didn't want the word blockchain in the fund, and then they were like, okay, fine, we'll call it the data transformational something or another, and then block is the ticker. we always wondered about that. It's like it's almost like the industry has this little bit of an ace up their sleeve if they really need it.
You can do. We can neither confirm nor deny.
I'm not thinking of any. Of
that's not
any,
the only
of
one.
Any example. I'm just saying.
Well, how about the marijuana one? Yeah. MJ is the ticker, but the name is like Emerging Agrosphere or something.
Well, actually, I am curious because you were at the SEC when cannabis came up. So how did the SEC evaluate all of a sudden? I could probably do a pun here, but all of a sudden there were a lot of cannabis themed ETFs.
Something that people sort of don't think of on the outside, which is you know, how the commission is how it takes in some of these products, right? In some cases, the product, everything about it is sort of under a rule. And so all you're looking at is the registration statement and making sure that meets the regulatory requirements for disclosure. In some cases, like the non-transparent ETFs, by way of example, they don't fall within the regulatory framework. So you have the whole exemptive process where the commission can have a much bigger role in shaping. So when the cannabis ETFs came in, they were in that disclosure space. So are you disclosing all the risks? Are you looking at any legal risks in that regard? So that one is just a focus of what is it doing? Are you saying what it's doing? And are you telling the world out there what, if any, potential liability you would have? And frankly, you know, can you sell it? Given the laws at the time.
And, you know, one thing we've seen over and over throughout history is Canada seems to, like, there'll be filings in the U.S. for something, and the SEC will, you can tell, be wrestling over it. And then Canada will just launch it. Like, they seem to have liberal regulators. That's how the first ETF came out, actually. Amex thought of it, but then shared the idea with Toronto Stock Exchange, and they launched it in Canada first. That didn't happen with fixed income. That didn't happen with cannabis. It's happened over and over. Do you care what Canada does at all? Like, are you, or does that give you an incubator to see, hey, did it work up in Canada? Maybe we'll be okay with it.
So, I mean, just speaking from my, you know, former hat, you always look at where the regulations and the products are developing in other jurisdictions. But it's always important to keep in mind that we are not another jurisdiction. Like the United States jurisdiction, we are the most sophisticated, most mature market. The ETF space, for example, fixed income, derivatives, we are the biggest market. So you can always look at what's happening somewhere else, but you have to keep your eyes grounded right here at home because our rules, our markets are different, and you shouldn't, you know, borrow regulation from other places simply because, like, you think they sound good. Like, you really have to think about, will it work here? Is it going to help our markets evolve and develop? Does it lend to market resiliency? Does it lend itself to innovation? But in a way that works in our markets.
Is there any quiet second guessing that goes on in the SEC where it's like, ah, we really should have done that differently?
That's a great question. You know, the SEC, and I will just give a sort of like a chapeau to the staff and the commission. They work really hard to make sure that they answer or get answers to the questions they have. I think sometimes that results in perhaps some frustration with the pace of working with the commission. But it really is to your point that you don't want to get to that place where you're like, you know, I missed something or didn't do something. Hopefully, if that ever happens, it's something that's pretty minor.
Well, actually, related to that then, because you've had multiple tour of duties and you were under Jay Clayton during your tenure, and now Gary Gensler's there, and that's who the head was at the conference. I'm assuming you've had others, SEC chairs in previous tours of duties. How much does the SEC really change based on who's in charge?
Great question. So I started under Chairman Donaldson. So that was, I'm dating myself here, right? by quite a bit. Look, I mean, the SEC is an organization of very professional staff, many of whom are career staffers who've been there for a very, very long time. And by virtue of that, they're actually experts in the markets and in the areas that they regulate. So, yes, I mean, when you get a different chair in an agency, the chair is the one that puts together the agenda for the agency. So you get different rulemakings. You can get different flavors here. But I think the piece that and the rulemakings are very public. But there is so much to the mission of the agency that's done by the career staff day in, day out. And those pieces tend to be pretty consistent. But the one, you know, significant difference, will, if you will, is the rulemaking agenda that is driven by the chair of the commission.
Can I ask then about how crypto was being talked about in your time there, and then what you make of what we've seen within the last few weeks and months?
So I think I have a pretty public letter around the, you know, Bitcoin ETFs. I think it was in, I can't remember the date now, but it was pretty early in my tenure when we published it. And that one, and we also did a request for comment on custody for investment advisors. And what we did there was sort of put it out there in the marketplace, very transparent. These are all the issues so that you understand where the staff is coming from. So when you're approaching us, you know where the questions are, and everybody knows where the questions are.
This was a big letter because this, though the filings were piling up. This sort of created, a lot more work in the prospectuses. I thought they would answer these as best they could, and over the next couple of years, they would have answered all these questions. But I do remember that was a huge, it was a little bit of cold water because there was a lot of questions.
We thought it was important to make sure the marketplace understood all the issues and transparently. So not, you know, if you came in to have a meeting with us, we would tell you, but it was really important for everybody else to have that information as well, not just you in a closed meeting. So everybody was on the same level playing field. Joel, we were talking earlier about sort of the touch point to the commission when products come in, be it like a rule or an exemption or disclosure. And what was happening was you were getting a lot of these registration statements filed when there were like very significant legal questions. And that was sort of like, you know, let's just, you know, not keep on just piling on registration statements. Let us answer those legal questions, think through them, and see where we can go. You know, obviously, it's still a, there's still lots of questions, Eric. I don't know what to say.
Yeah, no, this is something we've been tracking forever. It's now 11 years old, the horse race. The first one was filed by Winklevoss, and there's been 78 filings along the way. We actually tracked this whole big board, and, you know, most of them have been rejected. But now you've got a couple more filing. And the reason, as you can understand, is that if you're first with a spot Bitcoin ETF, you are an instant millionaire. You can probably buy a small island. It's like, again, I equated the Cannonball Run. You know, whoever gets to LA first in that movie gets all the money. It's a first to market thing. And so, of course, they're just going to like roll the dice left and right just in case, I don't know, you've shifted your mindset and you're like, now is the time. So I feel for the issuers, but I also feel for the SEC. It's just the... It is quite the situation, though. I call it a saga. It's now 11 years running.
Did the SEC have a big board that they just put? It was like, oh, here's another one.
So, you know, a few sort of threads to pull here. I think having the market having clarity on where the SEC is right now with respect to these products would be great. If you look at the safeguarding rule that was recently proposed, you know, there seems to be a more of a shutting the doors as opposed to anything else in the space. I think in the Bitcoin space, crypto asset space in general, frankly, more regulatory clarity, and this is not just about the SEC, would be welcome. I think any player in the space would agree probably with what I'm saying. So this is a space that regulatory certainty and clarity and allowing innovation with the proper market and investor protections would be fantastic. And I don't know that we're getting that. We're just getting a lot of like, we don't like this, so we will continue to, you know, not allow things to go out. So that needs some work. But in general, if you step back, even before we even get into this new asset class, ETFs are still not on the same playing field as just your typical mutual fund. There, and you know this, right? You talked about it, Eric, in the conference. There are still, for example, for non-transparent class ETFs, there are still assets that you can't run in non-transparent because it's outside the rule, and you still don't have an exemption for it. So I think for me, getting ETFs to a place where it's on par with mutual funds would be a fantastic step forward for a product that I think has really proved itself in the marketplace over and over again. So that's one. And then the other thing, which I think would be really helpful for ETFs, especially fixed income ETFs, is that they should be getting fixed income treatment, like not equity treatment for accounting purposes. I think that would just really help that product as well. So looking at ETFs to equalize them with mutual funds in terms of the offerings, because they are open-ended funds, but also looking at the ETF and sort of evolving that product to where it should be evolved because of its unique features is another place. And then going back to crypto and, you know, crypto assets and Bitcoin, I'd say regulatory clarity, appreciating that investors want this asset class and making sure that the, you know, it's being provided in the market in a way that meets investor protections, market resilience, all these things that, you know, have always helped our markets and made our markets what they are, like the best in the world. These are all good things.
And when I presented, by the way, I had to put a crypto slide in there, and I showed the percent premium of ETFs, spot Bitcoin ETFs overseas versus GBTC, which is like a closed-end fund. And the premium's all over the place, right? It's like a broken, you know, it's like a closed-end fund. The ETFs did a pretty good job during the past couple of years in other markets. And my point to them, because I had their ear, was like, trust the ETF or have faith in the ETF maybe even more than you have lack of faith in the crypto market, because a lot of the market makers are not going to fool around with like shady exchanges. And so those exchanges may actually up their game to get the money from the market makers. And if you could custody it with Fidelity, you're going to be way safer than you wouldn't have an FTX situation, because the ETF's transferable because your assets would be safe. So there were a couple reasons I thought the ETF, again, should be. But I totally understand all these other issues for sure. It's complicated, I mean, to say the least, especially after last year. So I get it. It's just, you know, it's one of these things we cover, and I get exhausted, frankly, because it's just like goes on and on and on.
This podcast is brought to you by Invesco QQQ. What do all the greatest innovations have in common? Agents, people who participate in progress by supporting cutting-edge ideas. Invesco QQQ is a fund that allows you access to innovators of the NASDAQ 100 all in one fund. So you don't have to be an inventor to help create what's next to come. Anyone can become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETF risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. The NASDAQ 100 index comprises the 100 largest non-financial companies on the NASDAQ. You can't invest directly into an index. Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit Invesco.com for a prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully before investing. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm really curious. This is a crazy moment in American culture, I think. Even investing has become partisan. And I'm curious about that, having been both on the public side of the SEC and then entering the private markets and publicly traded companies again. But what is it like to live through this moment where investing has become a partisan sport? And what concerns do you have for investors about that?
So it's not investing writ large, it's ESG.
Yeah.
Right. And I definitely was not expecting the moment as it happened, and the very strong views. But
from both
sides. Yeah. So, you know, if you're on one side, you have stakeholders accusing asset managers of not doing enough to address climate change or whatever social issue that is important to them, demanding that they adopt certain investment and stewardship practices to promote green finance and corporate social responsibility. And that's without regard to the fact that asset managers have a fiduciary obligation duty to asset owners. It's the asset owner that chooses, right? On the other side of that, you have stakeholders who are accusing asset managers of using other people's money for social or political goals that are not aligned with creating shareholder value. So the values versus value. And this is what has led to hundreds of anti and pro ESG bills across the U.S. I think this legislative session for the states was over 270, if I'm right about the number. So that's
like there was never any, and then all of a sudden, geyser.
If you look at last year versus this year, like the number has significantly gone up. I'd be curious, like next year, what the number would be. But it just really tells you how really divided we are here in the U.S. on the state level. Obviously, on the federal level, we're also divided. You're hearing that in the Congress and between the different parties. And then you also, if you're a global asset manager, you actually also have stakeholders in Europe, in Asia, in the Middle East, in Latin America that also have very strong views about this. So it's really difficult, frankly, to thread the needle and get to a place where there is a common understanding on these issues.
So where do we go from here?
So, you know, looking at the U.S., I think a couple of things. One is the term ESG. I think if I'm on one side of this debate, whatever I say, I'm not going to convince you and you're not going to convince me, and that's just not a good place to be. So we can't keep on using a term that everybody has entrenched around what it means. And think that we are going to find our way to a positive end result. So the term ESG has become in and of itself an issue. And unfortunately, the SEC rules would enshrine it, which would, you know, kind of enshrine the problem, if you will. The other part of it is when we are looking at the federal level, when we are looking at rules that help with the climate disclosure or other disclosures, just really making sure that we stay true, my opinion, to the U.S. system of market regulation, not adopting things, for example, from Europe. Europe has a very different system than ours. And that's not to say one is better than the other. It's just different. In Europe, pushing social policy through market regulation is a very well accepted practice. It's just how it works there. We don't do that. The U.S. market system is about full and fair disclosure. It's about market resiliency. It's about investor protection. It's a very different system. So staying true to what has worked for us would be great. And I think that was a topic that was also discussed pretty at length, actually, in the conference that you and I were at, Eric.
Yeah, ESG came up a lot. And part of the Europe-U.S. gap, I think, also is here we were told to we plan for our own retirements. We have 401ks. We become fund investors. We don't really assume the government's going to bail us out, or not bail us out, but like hook us up for retirement. Maybe we'll get a little bit from Social Security. In Europe, I don't think they're as tuned in. And also in Europe, you don't have any like Amazons and Teslas that you really want to capture in your portfolio. So they can screen stuff out with a little less worry. They're going to miss out on returns. So I do think there's a couple issues in Europe that I agree with you. It's not America. This is a different system here. ESG, the term, I agree. I say it's got baggage. You know, it's got so much baggage. It's become a political football. But like I was at a panel at Inside ETFs 2 months ago, and someone was like, we need to have someone sort of like unify, be like, look, none of us want polluted rivers, right? We all agree. Like there's definitely some common ground on ESG and the haters, maybe not everything, but the term itself has become like, it's just, you just go, it gets polarized and it's over. So I agree with basically both of those points.
Yeah. Okay, AI was another topic that came up at the conference, and I'm curious, how concerned about AI are you?
I'm a middle-aged woman, so AI is really above my level of understanding. I have a college kid who's studying computer science, so hopefully he'll explain it to me one day. Look, AI is it's novel. It's we're seeing it in so many different spaces. You know, Chair Gensler raised it during a conference as something that you know he is looking at, which I can understand when it's something that could fundamentally alter pieces of the market ecosystem. I think I understand it.
I mean, he said it would could be bigger than the internet, right?
Yeah, I was blown away. He was thought it could be bigger than the internet, and he had all kinds of he had a task force already going out looking at it. And this is just when AI was breaking in the press. But I get skeptical of these things that get hyped so quickly.
You know, I just let the market do its thing. But I think for me, it's really interesting when you have a focus on AI, when we are in technology minus 101, in some cases here in asset management space, we are still sort of talking about whether we should be allowing e-delivery. So we're not even internet stage, right? You know, before we talk about AI, I think there are some pieces of technological innovation that could really help investors. For example, if they can get their fund documents in a user-friendly way in an app, not in PDF, by the way, if we can even get to that. But we are like talking about AI when we're just, honestly, we still are talking PDFs and paper.
Fax so. Machines.
That's like that. Playoffs? Yeah. Let's just handle the regular season first.
Yeah, we're not even in overtime yet, right? I mean, just it's minus 101.
It's week four, all right? Yeah. Playoffs, let's just put that back.
So I'm curious. You have a new job. Sullivan and Cromwell, what are you doing?
I'm a lawyer, first and foremost, about 25 years now, almost out of law school. And I'm really, really excited about joining Sullivan & Cromwell because with the roster of incredible clients and incredible talented attorneys that I'll be working with, my partners and everybody else that makes up Sullivan & Cromwell, you know, to be at the front edge of like cutting innovation, you know, big regulatory questions and helping asset management through that. That's something that really excites me. So I'm really looking forward to that.
So if you ever found yourself doing another tour of duty at the SEC.
And I mean, head of AI.
Yeah, there's one. I mean, you have a consultant in your son, I think, by that point. What would make you lose sleep?
That's a great question. But by the way, I've done three, so that's more than enough for any lifetime. You know, I've never approached it that way. I've always approached it with this is an especially I'm just talking about the industry that I've sort of when I regulated. That was the only industry I regulated. It was always investment management. It's an industry that prides itself on regulation. They actually, very few people know this, but the 1940 Act, unlike the other federal securities acts, the industry was part of drafting it. They actually sat there with the Congress and the SEC in drafting it. They asked in some cases for more onerous provisions than what the SEC was recommending to Congress. So the industry prides itself on its history of participating in being part of the foundation for regulating itself and in being a regulator. And frankly, the industry is what it is today. It's thriving, it's big, it's growing. It's the biggest part of financial services. The asset management industry is bigger than insurance, bigger than banking. Because of that, you know, I think it's a great industry. So, you know, for me, I don't always think about the lowest common denominator. I don't always think that regulation should be at that level. I think about how to make sure that we meet those things that make the U.S. capital markets, you know, what they are and continue thriving, which is the full fair disclosure, making it accessible, making sure any innovation happens with the parameters of market resiliency, investor protection, but not losing sight of the fact that we have a really strong, resilient market and an industry that actually wants to be regulated and is happy being regulated. And for the most part, they do what's right.
Okay. Sometimes we ask a question.
This will be good. I'm curious what your answer is going to be.
Favorite ticker, other than your own, which I would say, you know, you've worked a couple of places that maybe you shouldn't be able to recommend something from.
So, Eric, you mentioned Inside ETFs. The very first, and I think it may have been, unfortunately, the only Inside ETFs conference. Love that conference, by the way, that I attended. There was a presentation where everybody got on stage in a pink T-shirt with the word she on it.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Tom Lydon led that charge.
I have that T-shirt.
Yeah.
So I would say that ticker was pretty good.
Good one.
That's good. That's a good answer.
There you go.
And with a little narrative memory attached to it? Yeah. Very good. Some people struggle with that question. Especially people who work at issuers. It's hard for them to pick another. Prepared.
But if I could come up with a ticker for myself, man,
yeah,
that would be good.
You could keep that to yourself. You might find yourself in the market again sometime. All right, Dahlia Bloss, thanks so much for joining us on Trillions.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to Trillions. Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, Bloomberg.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you like to listen. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter. I'm at Joel Weppershow. He's at Eric Balchunas. This episode of Trillions was produced by Magnus Hendrickson. Bye.
You don't have to be a rocket scientist to help realize a mission to Mars. Become an agent of innovation with Invesco QQQ. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.